Now it's your chance to enlighten us. Who's going to start the ball rolling? Let's take second row there. Would you stand up, and there's a microphone coming to you? Then everyone can hear.
Hi, I'm Dominic Mather from Bristol Cathedral Choir School. So, to Richard Coles, why do we need religion to fill the hole? Why can't it be something else?
I don't think religion fills a hole. I think I'm much more happy talking about faith than about religion. And I think faith is what is filled by everything else, if you see what I mean. I don't think that my way towards it was sort of experiencing a deficiency. It was about experiencing an appetite, something I wanted, something I needed, and finding satisfaction with that appetite there. But it wasn't filling a hole. It wasn't a snack. It was finding out that the whole thing was a banquet, the scale of which, the range of which, the deliciousness of which, I hadn't even imagined. There in front of me, but invisible.
Just another note to that, and another of my favourite quotes. Dennis Potter, the playwright, said, "Religion is the wound, not the bandage." He meant, you know, religion kind of grips it at some level of need. It doesn't just gloss over things. It opens up the vulnerability inside somehow. I think you had a question right in the front row. And who's after that, please? Yep, down there.
Hi, Hugh Westlake, Bromsgrove School. Question to the Archbishop. Being that the UK is a Christian country, do you think that Christian values should be given preference in political decisions that are made today?
Given that the UK is a Christian country, well, it's a nice thought. I'm not sure it is very these days. We've got a majority who would like to identify themselves as Christian. It's not quite where I'd like it to be in those terms. But Christian values. I think the Christian church always has to argue for its values to be accepted in public. You can't take them for granted. But a lot of people who don't share Christian belief do think, well, there's something about the values, about respect or about reconciliation or whatever, that really is worth enshrining. Or let's take welcome to strangers or needy people. That's not just a bit of neutral humanism. That is something very deeply rooted in a Jewish and Christian background. So yes, to that extent, I think they should. But you can't take it for granted. You still have to argue the case.
Can I add something to that?
Do.
If I might add something to that, I think that's right, that we're reaching a point of pluralism where we can no longer assume that Christian values are predominant. Certainly they're part of the heritage. But I think what public figures like the Archbishop need to be doing is to be prepared to argue their views in public. So they are views that have relevance for public policy, but they also need to be kind of open and transparent. They need to be debated. And then that's an issue about creating a shared public space in which those values can be exchanged, where we have some degree of civility and communication. Now, we may well be a long way from that in terms of some of the tensions in terms of public debate. And I think we have quite a long way to renew civil society and address issues of political scepticism and suspicion of the people over the road in the Houses of Parliament particularly. But that sense of religion not just having a public importance, which is what I was talking about, but being itself prepared to debate and take on the wider public square.
I think also it's worth remembering that Christian values are not always explicit or defined, and the church doesn't have the monopoly on them. You can find them cropping up in surprising places, often in ways which often are a challenge to the church, call us back to perhaps aspects. A friend of mine who is an atheist, dyed-in-the-wool atheist, we argue constantly about religion. And I said to him, okay, sum up for me in your own words, he's a highly moral person, thinks very carefully about what he does. I said, sum up for me your atheist creed. He said, easy. And I said, what is it then? And he said, do unto others as you would have them do to you. Well, if that's an atheist creed, I think I'd sign up to that.
Next there, and I think somebody further down, yes. And after that, over there, blue striped shirt.
Hi, I'm Edward Leach from St. Leonard's College in Ramsgate. Question for the Archbishop. You said that the church is for things that don't fit in the world. What do you class as things that don't fit in?
I think what I was trying to say was that in the kind of world we live in, a lot of the emotions that overtake us and the perspectives that come to us, sometimes in moments when we really feel under trial, under stress, those emotions aren't easy to deal with just in secular or world terms. We need some other framework. And for me, one of the eye-opening moments was when I was a bishop in Wales years ago, and there was a particularly nasty murder in one of our parishes. It was a council estate parish, very, very deprived and troubled. And a girl from the local school was stabbed on the way home one day. And the curate in the parish happened to meet a couple of other teenagers in the street, got talking about this tragedy, and eventually said, "So how would it be if I just left the church open for a couple of hours on Friday night and maybe you and your friends come in and sit for a while?" And she thought, well, maybe a dozen or so people would turn up. And about 80 kids from the school turned up just to sit quietly for a bit, light a few candles, drifted away. Now, that's the picture I have in my mind, the things that won't easily go anywhere else. You need to do something about the trauma, about the sense of being out of your depth. And that, at the very least, that's one of the things that the church still offers. More could be said.
You're not presumably talking about a kind of God of the gaps argument, that faith fills the bits that haven't been explained.
It's not a lot to do with explanation, really, is it? Again, it's what kind of world do you want to live in, a larger one or a smaller one? And I think the sense that people need to have that space for them says they'd rather live in a larger world. So, not explanations, though.
In bits that don't fit, losing, failing, getting it wrong, messing your life up, messing other people's lives up. Try and find that to fit into a public discourse which is dominated by the pursuit of ambition, the pursuit of success, the pursuit of prestige. All right, we have the cheering example of Peter Andre's tears on Sky Television last night. That's not an entirely facetious remark. But where do you take that stuff? Where in public discourse can you really reflect about your own sense of your own failure, your shortcomings, your weaknesses? We're not fully human unless we are able to participate in a conversation, an experience about that, I think.
Thanks. And down there, please.
Hi, James Ellis, Wellington College. I was just wondering, particularly for Reverend Coles, but to all of you, do you think it's more difficult to be taken seriously as people of faith in the media, in this age of scepticism that we live in?
Elaine, why don't you start?
Well, I'm a professor of theology, and as the Archbishop said, practical theology, so that begs the question of what else there is. And certainly I encounter some scepticism that theology is a valid discipline, a valid discourse, that it's more than just sort of idle speculation on things that one can't see. So I encounter it from that way. What's the use of theology? And actually, I think we're saying that it encounters some of the very deep and broad questions of what it means to be human and touches on matters of existence. I think there is an increasing kind of default position. It's very easy just to kind of label the media in a blanket way, but that's what I'm going to do. I think increasingly there is a default position of scepticism, and I'm sure the depiction of silly vicars doesn't help. Some of that, I think, is the way very often debates are set up, that they're polarised. And you've got to find, you know, one person at one extreme and one person at the other. And very often, certainly again coming from a more academic background where one wants to weigh the evidence and maybe reach a position, on reasoned argument, that way of trying to reach enlightenment by people battering one another doesn't seem very appropriate. So I think there may be something about the way in which often public debate is framed in oppositional ways and adversarial ways, which again perhaps affects Parliament, perhaps the media, pervasive in our culture.
The church at times.
And the church, yes. So, yes, I think there's a way in which perhaps debate is framed at that level that doesn't make it easy.
Richard?
I think I encountered two things which are most striking. One is intense curiosity, and the other one is extraordinary ignorance. And you often get this two come together. You'll have people who are kind of fascinated and beguiled by the notion of people finding it possible to live lives of faith. And then at the same time have... I think one of the problems is that people stop thinking about religion at the age when it ceases to be compulsory. So you'll have lots of people who stop thinking about Christianity when they were 8 or when they were 7. And they kind of know enough of the vocabulary to get in, but that's as far as it goes. And I think one of the most extraordinary things about the new atheism, I spent a lot of time on television programs and on radio programs talking to people like Richard Dawkins and people like that, who I find a fascinating, brilliant explainer of the natural processes of the world, who suddenly gets stupid when he starts talking about other processes in the world. And I just find it extraordinary that someone so acute can be so obtuse when it comes to matters of faith. It's very interesting, that, but I think it's a challenge and an opportunity, and it opens up a possibility for a new conversation.
I think it's right that there's an opportunity in this, but speaking of myself, I find there's a bit of a catch-22 here. If you talk very clearly and robustly out of the centre of your Christian conviction, then somebody will say, sorry, I don't understand, you're just talking jargon, doesn't mean a thing to me. If you try and talk in the language you think the public will understand, the answer is, well, you just sound like a politician. You know, that's, what's Christian about that?
Or a woolly liberal.
Or a woolly liberal, yes. Yes. Can't think why you should think that appropriate. that's the catch. And that means there are two different ways of sounding stupid if you're a cleric, especially an archbishop, talking in the media, and I'm afraid I've become very familiar with both of them.
But there are worse things than sounding stupid.
Thank you, Richard. Made my day. Now then, over there and in the front row afterwards.
Yes, Richard Ive from Ranelagh School, and this is a question for the Archbishop. One would think that religion needs faith, but faith isn't knowledge. So how do you make a choice between different faiths? What choice is there, and what views are right and which are wrong?
Okay. It's very few people, I think, who come up against the world of religion and just see it as, you know, five different makes of baked beans on a shelf and think, oh, I'll take that one. We all make those decisions in the middle of, you know, complicated lives, and so it's not quite abstract. That being said, if I were to turn it around and say, why do I think it's still worth being a Christian in spite of being aware of the other options? And why might I recommend Christianity rather than anything else to others? Then I would have to say, as a Christian, I think that the Christian understanding of God actually goes further than others in taking in, making sense of the worst experiences that humanity goes through, because we have the cross at the center of it. It tells us that there's no reality without relationship, the doctrine of the Holy Trinity. It tells us that the material world we live in is immensely precious and at the same time only part of what we have to take seriously. And I think, you know, that's a pretty good lineup of good reasons to think Christianity is worth bothering with. Now, immediately, I'm sure other people in the audience perhaps would say, well, I'm a Buddhist and these are my reasons. And then we have an argument, but that's where I'd start. Any other observations?
I don't think I chose. I think it chose me. I was born where I was born, to the parents I was born to. I grew up where I grew up. It was not really a choice, I think.
Now then, we've got somebody in the front row here. And did I see over there in the second row?
Hi, I'm Ellie Taylor from the Abbey School. Following from the question earlier about the role of religion in politics, I was wondering what the speakers thought about the Pope's recent criticism of the Equality Bill.
Oh, the easy ones first, is it? Well, I'll have a go. The Church of England wasn't happy with the drafting of the Equality Bill as it stood, as you probably know, and made its points through the bishops in the House of Lords last week. But the bishops did also say in that discussion, we have no disagreement with what this bill wants to do, but we think that the phrasing in one or two places leaves a great deal of unfinished business that could tie up the courts unnecessarily and put pressure on our organisations in ways that weren't there before. Right or wrong, that was how it was generally seen. The trouble is that it was immediately cast as a debate about the rights of certain people in society being denied by the church. And I'm not sure that what the Pope said quite got out of that trap. I haven't studied closely what he said, and it gave the Daily Telegraph a wonderful headline, of course, Pope Attacks Labour, which I'm sure was, was exactly what was in his mind. But I do think it's a difficult area to pick your way through. There's a sort of lurking question on the margins about religious freedom, by which I mean the freedom of a religious organisation to decide what it believes and what its boundaries should be in its own terms. And you set that against the need to be absolutely unambiguous about the rights of people under the law, whatever their gender, race, sexual orientation. I don't think it's a balance we've got quite right at the moment. And I'm not sure that to phrase it in quite the forceful way that was done in the Vatican has really taken us much forward.
Well, a number of observations. I think it's my understanding that the Pope was speaking not quite off the record, but certainly to a gathering of the bishops of England and Wales, so it wasn't a kind of public decree in that respect. But, of course, figures like that who speak off the record often find that it's very much on the record, and it relates perhaps to my response earlier on that, you know, when churches and faith groups and faith leaders make public pronouncements, they have to be prepared to justify and debate those if you like to speak as well as listen. I was at a meeting on Monday in Manchester of a group called the Equality and Human Rights Commission, which is the amalgamation of all the different equal opportunities, race relations, council, and all these things. And they now realise that they've got to take religion as part of their remit, and they're consulting various people like me to see how they do that. I'm not going to offer any profound insights into that, but simply to say that there is a body that is concerned with the issue of rights and how that's enshrined in legislation for the UK, and they are very exercised at the way in which the claims of some religious people may contradict or oppose or certainly need to be balanced against the rights of other minorities. So it returns, in a sense, to some of the comments I was making in my presentation. Here's another question, which in a sense is about the gaps between people who have very firm commitments in some respects and others who are striving for equality in different ways. So I think that's just to show that at government levels, at the levels of advice and policy, people are really struggling with the competing claims, if you like, of people with strong faith commitments, people with disabilities, people of other minorities. And that's something, again, about the nature of civil discourse and the kind of nation we want to be.
Quick comment, Richard? I used to be a Roman Catholic, and I'm now an Anglican. And one of the reasons why I'm an Anglican and not a Roman Catholic is because we don't have popes defining doctrine. We have debates. We have arguments. It's awkward for me because I am a gay man, and issues of equality have long been very dear to me. And to be a gay man interested in equality, who's also a member of a church, is a particularly awkward position to be in lots of ways, because that debate is so hot. And I'm not looking to embarrass anybody by saying so. It's just the fact. But also the fact is that my faith requires me to understand that I am accountable to my brothers and sisters in the faith who don't think what I think, who may be very far from my position, and that's going to involve sacrifice and patience on all our parts as we continue to have that debate. There's something peculiarly Anglican about finding the patience and the persistence in debate that we need to have at the moment. I don't know where we're going with that. It's pretty deadlocked at the moment. But I think it's the right place to be. And I think one thing as Anglicans we can do is show how we may disagree. At the moment, we can't show how we agree. We might have something to value in showing how we disagree.
Something to do with all that stuff about respect and reconciliation, maybe, which we aren't doing brilliantly with. Question over here. And then just back there, and then up here.
My name is Bethan Harris. I'm from Bishop Llandaff High School in Cardiff. To whoever, I'm not first. My question is, a lot of things were mentioned, like the media and technology and aspects of society play their part in undermining faith. But do you think that to some extent, the church in itself helps to undermine faith in that its traditional mindset prevents it from relating to a modern generation.
Thank you. Elaine?
Yes, I'm not sure that the trends that I was pointing to necessarily undermine faith all the time. I think they represent both challenges and opportunities in lots of different ways. And of course, you know, time after time, when people are polled within the general public, there is this distinction between institutional religion, which in some way cramps people's style, and broader spirituality and faith and things like that. So I'm sure you two have had it as public representatives. People say, oh, I'm not religious, but I am spiritual. Mm. And there does seem to be something about institutions and resistance to institutions that is certainly there in the way people express faith. But, of course, increasingly it's there the way people identify themselves politically in terms of membership organisations in all sorts of ways. And maybe this is a uniquely British thing about a suspicion of joining and of being bound by organisations. And certainly I think there are ways in which the institutional faith and doctrines often are off-putting to people and seem old-fashioned, particularly to a younger generation. But I think there are lots of ways in which institutions are important. They maintain a continuity. They're the bearers of stories, which are important. And in many areas, the kind of places Richard was talking about, inner city areas, and I know this from my work in urban theology, institutional religion often holds the memory of a place. It embodies bricks and mortar. It embraces what we might call the social capital, the capacity of faith communities to mobilize for the common good, which I think is the positive side of institutional expressions of faith. Even though sometimes they can be cold, literally and metaphorically, they can be exclusive and they can do a lot of damage. So it's much more about living with institutions, like any human organisation or phenomenon, that are both forces for good and forces for evil.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a great deal in that. I think the problem is that very often when people look at churches as they actually are, what they see is not so much what churches are really talking about or really pointing to, as a whole set of practices that are just eccentric. And here are people sitting in rows and singing together, usually in a rather dreary way, and here are certain patterns and expectations about relationships that seem, again, very remote. And all of that can, I think, undermine the credibility of the church. I don't think there's a quick answer, but you're right to that extent. But I want to pick up what Elaine said and just take it a tiny bit further. Tradition isn't a bad thing in itself. Traditionalism is usually a very bad thing. Tradition is, if you like, what's handed on as sensible, insightful, enriching ways of looking at things. And in that sense, I say three cheers for tradition. Traditionalism is really saying you can never do anything for the first time. But when I think of the tradition of the church, I don't first think of, what colour you paint the pews. I tend to think of the creed, which to me is a hugely exciting document. It's something which, going back to my earlier language, shows me the big world that we're supposed to live in. You know, this is what we say about God. Wow, this is what we say about God's involvement with the world. And, you know, it's massive, it's exhilarating. And I don't want to let go of that, because it's part of what makes that bigger world possible. So it is very much a matter of balancing the unavoidable institutions that hand on good tradition with the ways in which all of those keep on freezing up and seizing up.
If you get a chance, go over to Westminster Abbey and you'll find in a cloister there the oldest door in Britain. Don't know if you've seen it. It's a door that was installed for Edward the Confessor in the 1050s, and they did some, I think it's called dendrochronology, they dated the wood and they found that it was growing in the 10th century in Essex. And I love that door. There's something about the thought of people for 1,000 years going in and out of that door into the precincts of the Abbey that reminds me that the moment is just the moment. And it is happening within a huger history, an unimaginable history. And to take an opportunity to reflect upon the characteristics of that moment in the wider context is a useful thing to do. I think religion is very good at that, actually.
Thanks, Narvin. Another one over there and just here.
Hi, I'm Anna Dominey from Lady Margaret School in West London. And I've got a general question, which is how does one become moved by God and how does one learn to love God?
Wow. Right.
Archbishop.
How long have we got? It's a pretty fundamental question, isn't it? I think most people are first stirred to want to know God or to love God by looking at the lives of other people who seem to show that it's worthwhile. To use an extremely irreverent analogy, some of you at least will have seen the film When Harry Met Sally and will remember the famous restaurant scene in that where somebody says, "I'll have what she's having." Now, sometimes, you know, we look at another life and we say, that's worth something. So I think one way of getting into it is just watching a bit what religious people do, people of faith do, who are serious human beings, and seeing what it might be like to live a bit like that. But the second thing, which I think there's no substitute for, is the habit of silence. Just making time for being nothing but receptive, trying to clear your mind, breathe steadily, and, as it were, say to whatever reality there is, "I want to make room for you." And who knows? Things do happen. But it is often triggered by that sense, well, there's a life I'd like to understand better. I'll have what they're having.
I think for me it was having grown up in the Christian faith and then having been away from it and seriously away from it for most of my adult life. It was when I first got to sort of realize that I had a hunger for this, the first person I went to see was a psychiatrist. It seemed to be a sensible thing to do, and the psychiatrist very sensibly recommended I go and see a priest. I didn't know a priest, but I knew someone who was married to a priest, and she sent me along to church. And what happened to me, it was a high church, St. Albans Holborn, one of the great shrines of the Anglo-Catholic movement, and it's very smells and bells. There's no business like show business. And I went along there, not knowing anything. I went along as a spectator, and the bell rang, and the incense rose, and I knew that I wanted to be and was a participant and not a spectator. Didn't work it out. I didn't read a book. It wasn't the sermon. It wasn't the hymn. It was all of a sudden just realizing that I wasn't a tourist. I was at home.
I was very struck by the Archbishop talking about Etty Hilson and saying that she chose this crazy, unusual, risky way of life. And the thought that came to me was that was very much about someone being claimed by something, something bigger than themselves. And that certainly was my experience. And when Richard was talking, the word that came through my mind was people talking about a conversion or a religious conviction as coming home. It just clicks. It all comes together. And it's not so much, well, perhaps it is about having gaps filled, but it's also about pieces of your life just fitting together and making sense. There's an integrity, yeah. Which, you know, it's just really, everything comes together in that way. People of faith, I think, need to take seriously the fact that, as the Archbishop says, they are God's ambassadors, and that's a very serious and very elevated calling. And I just think sometimes people of faith should listen and wait and be silent more and speak less. Sometimes I think there can be too much activism and too much preaching at the world and actually listening to the everyday stories. And, of course, the Christian tradition talks about God and the face of God being known most completely in the faces of the outcast, the poor and the marginalised. And that, again, I think, is an object lesson and something that that I feel very very exercised by and which I think is an important judgment to be made.
And there's a real challenge there for anyone interested in media. Silence. They have this circuit at the BBC where if anything's silent for longer than, I think, 14 seconds, a tape of... Who is it? I think it's Peter Andre kicks in automatically, depending on what network or not, and they call it. Do you know what they call silence? They call it dead air. Well, I'd like a bit more dead air.
I think we can manage two more. One here and Let's go to the back, because... Yes, thank you.
Hi, my name's Linda Adesanya. I'm from Race Foundation Sixth Form. My question is directed to the Archbishop. Basically, I wanted to ask, 9% of the British population is claiming to be attending church, and that's one of many facts that British society is becoming more secular. Not a while ago, you made a comment saying Sharia law should be integrated into the UK law to cater for British Muslims. But I thought maybe, however, as like we're losing our traditional norms and values, shouldn't we be reintegrating Christian values back into society?
I spent quite a lot of my time explaining what I did and didn't say in the lecture on Sharia law. So I'll have to do it again, I'm afraid. Because actually what I was arguing there was there's something a bit wrong if the law of a state attempts to solve every problem for every community rather than allowing communities to shape their own moral codes as well. So the suggestion was really, is there any place for some aspects of Muslim law to be, if you like, recognised in British law as ways of solving certain kinds of problems? Not wholesale, and not replacing anything. But can some issues about, I don't know, inheritance, money, some issues about family be dealt with by Sharia bodies? I think the response, let's say the reasoned response, was, well, maybe, but not terribly convinced. One or two lawyers agreed, some disagreed. But what I was saying in the lecture overall was the real risk is exactly what you say. It's of losing the visible presence of clear communities with clear values in society. And if the law of the state thinks it can resolve everything top down, it's misunderstood its own calling. So Christians, Muslims, Jews, anybody else ought to be making common cause about this and saying, well, we do want to, what Elaine was talking about really, we do want to have a part in the argument about this. We do want to be there in the public domain. I think that's what I was attempting rather unsuccessfully to say. Could we take the one towards the back who had that? Yeah, yes. If you stand up. Thank you.
Hi, sorry, the other James from Wellington College. Professor, you mentioned the rise of Richard Dawkins and other such figures and their new atheism. Do you think that that poses a threat not just to Christianity and other religions in our society, but also to a basic level of faith, as in a trust between two friends or something like that? Thank you.
Thank you. I think it's perceived as a debate about the existence of God very often. And as Richard said, Richard Dawkins is a very articulate and passionate speaker and arouses strong feelings wherever he goes, both pro and anti. I think underneath that is a model of science that does slightly disturb me. I'm not anti-evolution in any way, and I'm one of the people who believes fully that religious worldviews and scientific evolution can be reconciled. There's something about Dawkins in particular and his idea of the selfish gene and the sociobiology that says we're evolution is dominated and human behaviour is dominated by the demands of our genetic survival, that seems to me quite reductive in terms of its understanding of human nature and human behaviour. So in terms of how we understand one another as individuals and how we understand an encounter between two people, I would be concerned if that worldview became so predominant that we understood that all we were was just kind of bundles of genes and genetic material wandering about, and we were determined by some non-human process like that. I think I want to understand human behavior as much more complex than that. Certainly to understand ourselves as part of the natural world. You know, we are part of the animal kingdom and the broader world of nature, but also to understand other aspects that can't be explained by that very reductive kind of science, such as the imagination, such as art, creativity, loss, pain, human meaning. Those are the things I think that we need in order to build up a rounded understanding of ourselves and other people.
And I think Richard Dawkins acknowledges the poverty of what he has to offer. in those terms. And he's written lately, quite interestingly, quite beautifully sometimes, about the wonder he feels at the complexity of human processes, at the vastness of the universe. But I think what I would say to him is no one's going to build a cathedral to that. And by that I don't mean just a big building. I mean something which manages to contain both the vastness of the cosmos and the intimacy of being a living human being. I don't think he can quite offer something for that hunger.
No, I think that both those remarks are absolutely on the ball, because my own worry about the Dawkins approach, and I think it's very interesting that you generalise it from religion more widely, quite rightly, one of the things that worries me is the idea, this is the only explanation. This is the only explanation. Now, I think in the real world, we use different kinds of explanation in different areas. Why is this happening? There may be six equally good answers to that. Richard Dawkins is in danger, I think, of saying, there's just one basic answer, and it's genetics, it's biogenetics. That's it. And having said that, he then introduces this curious idea that somewhere inside us, there are lots of little blokes called genes. They've all got purposes and ideas and their aims are selfish and competitive. It's a jungle in there. But, you know, there are no little blokes inside us. There is no such thing as a gene. There is no such thing as a gene. A gene is a convenient word that we use for certain clusters of behavior and interaction among our, in the midst of our genetic material. But there aren't little things there. And what amazes me is the way in which people buy so easily into this profoundly mythological view of what's going on. The selfish gene gives it away. There's a little bloke in there and he's selfish. He's not very nice. Get a lot of them together in one place like a human being. And it's no surprise if human beings aren't always very nice. Well, give me strength. You know, that really is not how scientific analysis ought to be working, suddenly importing this melodrama about nasty little blokes running around inside. So I'd want to push back a bit on what I think is the mythology that people like Richard Dawkins work with and say, the human world is one in which we quite rightly use lots of explanations, lots of frames of interpretation. There's no one to which everything else can be reduced in terms of which everything goes. So your question is absolutely right. Take Dawkins seriously, and a great deal about routine, human trust, love, and imagination goes down the tubes as well. I'm sorry, we're over time. But I hope there'll be a bit of opportunity for more conversation informally in the next... well, nearly an hour, I think, where we've got to wander around and look at posters and so forth. So at this stage, let me just say a very, very warm thank you to everyone who's come, to the schools who've got people here, once again to Church House for making us so welcome and so comfortable, and of course, on your behalf, to Elaine and to Richard for their contribution. Thank you.